This is the La Carre Cast.
Hello and welcome to La Carre Cast. My name is Jeff and I'm your host. Now, in the past, I've been criticized for being an American talking about La Carre. So to balance the scales, I thought let's go for the big guns. Someone whose British credentials can't be questioned, someone who knows their Athelstans from their Ethelreds, someone who is probably, you know, drinking both high tea and a pint right now, someone currently eating bangers and mash while waving the Union Jack, Dominic Sandbrook. Dominic is the historian for mid-20th century British history, with books such as State of Emergency, Seasons in the Sun, and The Great British Dream Factory. He's hosted television and radio documentaries, and currently co-hosts the enormously successful podcast, The Rest is History, and most recently is author of the children's book series, Adventures in Time. Dominic, thank you so much for coming on to talk La Carre.
It's a great pleasure. I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm very honored that you've asked me on your show.
Well, thank you. First, I want to start, how did you first encounter La Carre? When did that happen for you?
So I was born in 1974, and I didn't read La Carre till maybe 20 years later, so the mid-1990s. And I can remember the first one I read was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which I'm sure we'll be talking about in due course. And I was on holiday in Wales. So to give I guess a lot of your listeners are American, so to give them some sense, a holiday in Wales basically involves it raining a lot. So, you know, I was inside with my parents and I read Tinker Tailor probably in, you know, a day, 2 days. I was completely hooked. Sometimes you go on holiday and it's, the weather is terrible and there's something about it, I think, the slight sort of melancholy that lends itself to complete immersion in a book. So having read Tinker Tailor, I then thought, God, you know, I should have read this years ago. I did that thing that you do, I think, when you're young. You say, well, I'll read them all. I was in Wales, so obviously Wales, no offense to any Welsh listeners, but Wales is about 100 years behind England. So I had to rely on kind of charity shops, secondhand bookshops. So when we went out, when we went to a town or something or a village, I would check out the secondhand bookshops or whatever. And they always had loads of La Carres, because obviously La Carre in Britain had been just such a colossal seller throughout the 1970s and 80s. So those paperbacks were precisely those paperbacks that people basically would read on holiday and then they'd give away or whatever. So they'd end up in secondhand bookshops. And, you know, I picked up, I think, Smiley's People and The Honourable Schoolboy. And then I just started to read them all. So I went through, this is like the 90s. I read all the early stuff and then I would read them up until they came out. I would say until probably the mid-2000s. When controversially, he says on a La Carre podcast, I think there is a definite diminution in quality. And definitely, I've written about this, so I don't feel bad saying it. I think there's a definite element of preachiness, which there isn't in the earlier books. So yeah, that's my story with La Carre. By the end of the 90s, early 2000s, I'd become a historian. About to say I'd become an adult, but that's obviously not true, really. So I had become a historian, so I was writing about 60s, 70s Britain. And La Carre is a brilliant source, because I think more than any other novelist of the era, he captures something of the mood of Britain, particularly in the 70s, I think. So I'm sure we'll talk about that. So I then was almost reading La Carre professionally, rereading it, I mean. And then I was invited to do for Penguin. Penguin reissued or bought, or I don't know exactly how it worked, but basically Penguin Classics picked up a lot of La Carre's work, his backlist. And to celebrate this, they did special editions and they asked me to write an introduction, which was like a pamphlet. And you could get it in Britain's biggest bookstore chain, Waterstones. It's sort of an essay, basically putting La Carre into historical context. So I did that, and then I've done other La Carre things. So in the Sunday Times, which I write for in London, I reviewed, I think it was probably the first review of his memoirs, and then the first review of Adam Seizman's biography, and then the other stuff that's come out. So I've written a lot about La Carre over the years, without it being a deliberate policy, but he just seems to have come up again and again. I think that's inevitable when you're thinking about kind of post-war Britain, because he's such a colossal cultural figure.
Well, and this is the 50th anniversary of Tinker, June of 2024. And I want to dive into that because, to put it in context, when it came out, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, enormous blockbuster success. His next two, The Looking Glass War and Small Town in Germany, quite successful and well-reviewed in the U.S., less so in England, I think, from what I read. But his next, the Naive and Sentimental Lover, is like a complete disaster.
Yeah.
That comes out in 71, right? He gets rid of the spies. It's a thinly veiled look at his weird relationship with James and Sue Kennaway. And I'd say in regards to his literary career, it feels like his next book is kind of make or break it, right? I mean, he had the one success, everything's okay, but then what's next for him, right?
Yeah.
So he'd done two novels before The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and they were fine, but they weren't colossal hits. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold was obviously a huge success, and then the film, of course, the film, which, I mean, I'm sure you agree, is brilliant, and you can watch it now, and it doesn't feel as all dated. But you're right. I think by the early 70s, you know, the mood of the Cold War had changed as well. So I suppose there was a question mark about could he adapt. I mean, he wasn't really seen actually as a Cold War novelist at that point. He had done one book about the Cold War, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. But as you say, The Naive and Sentimental Lover doesn't have spying in it at all, I think. A Small Town in Germany, I guess, and The Looking Glass War. I mean, it's there, but he hadn't quite hit on the atmosphere, I think, of those 70s books. And I think you're right that if the next book had been a dud or had just been, you know, received indifferently, then maybe Le Carré would now be forgotten. I mean, maybe The Spy Who Came In From the Cold would be remembered, but his longevity is remarkable. And I think Tinker Tailor obviously was a huge hit and it absolutely captured the mood of mid-70s Britain. And then he built on it with The Honourable Schoolboy, again a big hit, and Smiley's People. And then, of course, in Britain, the TV series, the TV adaptations with Alec Guinness. I mean, they're what most people think of when they think of Le Carré. The image that swims into their heads is Alec Guinness sort of blinking behind those glasses. And that would not have been possible if Tinker Tailor had not been so perfectly conceived. I absolutely think that is the book, probably even more than The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, for which I think he'll always be remembered. I mean, The Perfect Spy is a better book, to my mind, a greater artistic achievement. But there's something about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, something about the atmosphere that it captured, and the sense of almost all Britain's post-war history being in it, in a way even more than in A Perfect Spy. I think that sets it apart.
And he goes back to Smiley, who we haven't seen as a lead character for over 10 years in books, and which, as you said, weren't huge sellers at the time. So it feels like kind of almost like a roll of the dice a little bit there.
Yeah, I guess. But I think the Smiley and Tinker Tailor is so much richer and more layered than he is in the earlier books. I mean, in Tinker Tailor, the idea of Smiley being recalled to the colours, that the stuff with Anne, the sense that he carries this great weight of melancholy and of disappointment and repressed tragedy, I guess, means that Smiley feels like an extraordinary character to me when you reread Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy in a way that he didn't when his earlier appearances. So he's in Call. Is he in Call for the Dead? I can't remember.
He is, yeah.
He's definitely in A Murder of Quality, isn't he?
Yep.
I just think the Smiley in the 70s, bringing him back. You see, I don't think it's not like people are like, oh, Smiley is back, amazing. Because Smiley wasn't a character that had any currency in the popular imagination. You know, I've spent far too much time writing my history books, reading newspapers and things, or diaries or whatever, from the 60s and 70s. Smiley's not an archetype. You know, it's not like James Bond. He's not somebody that people mention in conversation, which they kind of do a little bit now. I mean, not enormously, but if you say to somebody who's well-read, oh, so-and-so is like George Smiley, they know who you mean. They wouldn't have known who you meant in 1973. So I think it's Tinker Tailor that gives him his symbolic resonance, I guess. I mean, I don't know whether he or his publishers thought it would be as big a hit as it was. I think it's very, very perfectly timed because he must have been writing it in, what, 1973? Thinking about it in 1972? Because it comes out in, I think, June, the summer of 74.
Yep.
So assuming a 12-month lead time or thereabouts, he writes it just before one of the great sort of nadirs in British political history. for those, I imagine, you know, the vast majority of listeners won't be massively familiar with it, but Britain had two elections in 1974. It had just had five states of emergency in 3.5 years, the implosion of the Conservative government, the imposition of a three-day working week with power turned off to shops and offices for 2 days a week because of the oil crisis, a miners' strike, just a total sense of kind of post-imperial meltdown and malaise, I guess. And malaise, obviously, your American listeners will remember Jimmy Carter and his malaise, but the one in Britain in the earlier in the 70s, even more pronounced. This sense of, I think, shabbiness that you get in Tinker Tailor, which is really, really strong in some of the descriptions of London, or the description, you know, there's a scene where, and I think it's the first time we're in the circus, and there's a description of the lift doesn't work, everything is broken, there are just old pictures on the walls that no one has bothered to replace, the wallpaper is peeling, the floors are kind of squeaky, everything is 10 years out of date and just a bit decrepit. And all the people themselves are decrepit and disappointed, aren't they, in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy? It's one of the things that gives it that wonderful kind of melancholy quality. And there's that scene when Smiley goes to see Connie Sachs, and she's absolutely wasted, isn't she? She's kind of been drinking sherry for the last 10 years or whatever. And she says, poor loves all trained to rule the empire, all gone, or words to that effect. And she's talking about Smiley and their generation, really. And that sense, I think, that absolutely mirrored what a lot of people felt in 70s Britain, that they had somebody like Smiley, or Le Carré, actually. Well, Le Carré himself is a good example of this. I think it's what explains a lot of Le Carré's subsequent anti-Americanism. So Le Carré was born in 1931. So he would have grown up and he would have gone to school in a world where you had maps on the classroom walls. There were literally coloured in great splashes of pink. Imperial pink was the colour to show Britain's possessions. And, you know, he's a teenager in the Second World War. And then the story afterwards is one of gradual diminution and decline. And for, I think, a lot of people of his generation, they just felt they'd been deprived of something, the chance to make a mark, greatness, a sense of adventure, that everything was a little bit, I mean, you see this in almost all Le Carré's books, a sense of narrowed horizons, disappointment, moral compromise, all of this kind of stuff. And I think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy captures that absolutely perfectly, because almost all the characters in that book are weighted down, that they have a terrible sense that hopes betrayed and disappointed, possibilities closed off, sort of secrets half buried, all of that kind of thing. And that matched the more general mood in 1974 in Britain between the two elections. We had a new Labour government, but it was kind of very shabby. It was a shabby retread, actually, of a government that had been there in the 60s. So we've got a prime minister who returned in Harold Wilson, who was a very crumpled, diminished version of his earlier self. I think it's hard for me to think of a better example of a novel meeting a kind of political and cultural moment than Tinker Tailor.
Well, and you do quite, I thought, funnily, in Seasons in the Sun, compare Harold Wilson to Smiley,
right?
Throughout, because there is a bit of a comparison there for the two characters.
Yeah, there is. So Harold Wilson's a bit older than Smiley. And obviously, this isn't deliberate on Le Carré's part at all, but I think it's sometimes fun to see what might be accidental parallels. Harold Wilson had been the sort of modernizing Labour Prime Minister elected in 1964. And at the time, he wore this coat, which was seen as emblematic of his commitment to modernization. And it was a kind of plastic raincoat. And it was the kind of coat that British prime ministers hadn't worn before, because it's modern and it's made plastic and it's kind of shiny, made of a substance called Ganex. And at the time, in the 60s, you know, Wilson gave awards to the Beatles. He was photographed with the Beatles. It's kind of swinging London. Yeah, he's kind of the coming man. And then when he comes back in 1974, he's absolutely exhausted. He seems like he's aged a lot. He's drinking too much. He's run out of ideas. So he's come back really because the Conservatives have fallen apart and Labour have returned almost by default rather than with any great sense of optimism or anything. And Wilson seems like a kind of shabby, pudgy little man in his sort of, his suit is kind of flecked with dandruff or whatever, and it's very crumpled. And there's a sense of, just an enormous sense of disappointment and weariness to him. Smiley is also making a comeback at exactly the same time, and he basically looks exactly like Harold Wilson. And I just sort of thought, yeah, the whole point about Smiley, of course, is that he's not James Bond. I mean, that's a huge part of his personality, of his persona in terms of the public perception of him. That, as Le Carré famously said in the 1960s, he found Bond as a kind of repellent fantasy figure. So Bond is like how Britain wanted to see itself and how Britain believed it had been. And Smiley is as Britain is. And Britain wants to deny it to itself. But that's what it is. It's disappointed. It's kind of, its wife has run off with somebody else. Everything has gone wrong. And physically, it feels in bad shape. Well, Harold Wilson is just like that. He seems a diminished figure by comparison with prime ministers of the past. It's that sense of diminution and decline, which I, as a historian, quite apart from the literary qualities of Tinker Tailor, which are obviously considerable, or the sort of the sheer excitement of the plot, for me as a historian, it's that sense of seediness, of kind of shabbiness, of regret, all of that kind of stuff that feels so of its time and gives it that rich atmosphere. You know, you just open the pages, flick through the pages, and you're catapulted into that world where nothing works and it's permanently raining, that sort of atmosphere. I think it's brilliantly done.
I hadn't thought of that Harold Wilson comparison until I read your book.
Yeah.
And then Smiley has this tormentor in Anne. Wilson has his own political female tormentor.
He does. Yes, he does. He had a very peculiar ménage, I think is the word, at number 10 Downing Street, because his wife, Mary, had no interest in politics at all. She had married Harold Wilson thinking he was going to be an Oxford Don, an Oxford academic. And he disappointed her by going to politics. And he has this political secretary called Marcia Williams, who basically controls access to him. You know, it's a familiar thing. Politicians have, yes, very, very often powerful aides or assistants. But Marcia was a very disputatious woman, I think it's fair to say. Strong personality. Most of everybody else pretty much hated her. And at one point in 1974, so that summer when Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy is coming out, Wilson, some of his other aides actually seriously discuss murdering her with his doctor, which seems like an unbelievably implausible and baroque thing to do. And too implausible even for, you know, certainly too implausible for a Le Carré. It's much more Ian Fleming, but it definitely happened. So yeah, there are some kind of weird parallels, which I think are quite fun to consider.
You know, in the US, the 70s were all about paranoia, right? That paranoia conspiracy thing going on. Well, in Tinker, it feels like it's more focused on betrayal. And does that better fit the mood of Britain at the time, betrayal versus paranoia?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a little bit of crossover in the paranoia stakes. The 70s are a really bleak time for Britain, much more so than for the United States. Not least because in Britain at the time, the IRA bombing campaign was at its height. There are British troops in Northern Ireland. That's always going on sort of in the background. So, you know, you go into a pub in London and it's not utterly impossible that you could be blown up. That's pretty terrifying. And it just, people just accepted it and got on with life. So there's a kind of darkness, definitely, to the public conversation. But I think the shadow that's obviously over Tinker Tailor is a slightly older one, which is the defection and the betrayal of the Cambridge spies. I mean, it's a great irony. The United States had McCarthyism and Britain didn't. But in Britain, there was probably more justification for it because there were Donald MacLean, Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, John Cairncross, Anthony Blunt. These characters who had basically been recruited in the 1930s and had been passing secrets to the NKVD or later the KGB. I think for somebody like Le Carré, working in the intelligence service when he did, so what's that, late in the 50s and then into the 60s? In fact, he works for both, doesn't he? He works for MI5 and MI6.
Yeah.
For somebody like him, in that world was traumatized by the betrayals and the defections. And there's basically a sense that British establishment has been penetrated by Soviet intelligence. You can't really trust anybody. And of course, particularly within those institutions, MI5 and MI6, there's just a real sense of, I think, of failure, of self-doubt, of these are the dirty secrets that you don't really want to talk about. And I think that's obviously the shadow that hangs over this book. The fact that Britain had suffered the shock, I guess, of people right at the top of the establishment. I mean, that's the story of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, that it's almost the person you don't expect. And I think one of the geniuses of the book, the really clever things about it, is that the mole's, I don't know whether you're allowed to give away who the mole is, the mole's motives are not so dissimilar from Le Carré's. There's a lot of Le Carré in the mole, that he feels at the end of the book, the mole says, that sense of Britain doesn't count for anything anymore. He's very anti-American. He feels the weight of disappointment just as much as his creator, as the author does. And I think that's what makes it so interesting. That basically Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy is a reckoning with that sense of betrayal and of infiltration, but also the sense of national decline and the loss of empire. Because I think it really is, I think it's very much a loss of empire book as much as anything else.
Yeah. So talking about his writing, because, you know, I know you know the historical aspect of things backwards and forwards, but when you think of his writing overall, I think you're right in that Tinker takes it to another level. The characters just leap off the page for whatever reason there than others. When you look at some of his other books that you found successful along those lines, what else kind of jumps out at you as defining a Le Carré novel?
Oh, so I think The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, let's not underrate The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is a brilliant book. It succeeds because it gives you a sense of exclusive access to a secret world. I think that's what spy novels do generally. A sense of induction into an underground, I guess. So it gives you that. It captures atmosphere brilliantly. So it's Alec Lemus, isn't it, the protagonist? And that sense, again, with him, but Carré does this so well, I think, better than almost any other writer. A sense of shabbiness and disappointment and regret and all those kinds of things, which are obviously, I mean, they're him, but they're also part of his cover story. I think that's all fantastic. And then I think what's really bracing about reading The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, so I didn't read that until I was writing my first book on 50s, 60s Britain, which is called Never Had It So Good. And I'd been reading all these James Bond books and other books of the era and stuff. And The Spy Who Came In From the Cold just seems so sophisticated intellectually and kind of morally. I think the moral sophistication of it and the moral complexity is what sets it apart. The conversations that he has about what a spy is, Lemus, with the guys in East Germany, isn't it? The sense of self-loathing about what he's up to in the Cold War. I loved all that. And the sort of presence of the Berlin Wall and all that. I think that's brilliantly done. And then I think presumably every contributor to your podcast always says this, that a perfect spy is in many ways, I think a Tinker Tailor, because of its atmosphere and because I'm just so steeped in the 70s, is special. But a perfect spy, if you had to give a Le Carré book to somebody who didn't like spying and who didn't like spy stories, and you just had to say, here you go, this is a great work of literature, irrespective of the subject matter, then I think A Perfect Spy is right up there. It's very, very Dickensian. I love that about it, that the characters are all called, you know, Jack Brotherhood or whatever. They have kind of slightly Dickensian names. That wonderful figure of the monster father, Rick Pym, he is a really Dickensian creation. He's absolutely terrible, but he's so charismatic. And you love it when he comes back, whenever he's on the page. Of course, Axel is a fantastic character, but just that sense of Magnus's life mapping history, moving through time, the sense of, I mean, it's obviously a very sophisticated book in a literary sense because it's all about the fictions that we make of our own lives and the extent to which any persona that we present to the world is contrived and confected. So I often say with that book, and indeed Le Carré's fiction generally, it seems like it's about spying, but it's not really about spying. It's actually just about being human. You can have no interest in the Cold War or in MI5 or MI6. You can just be interested in the way in which we lie to ourselves and to each other. We betray people. We hide behind masks. We create our own fictional narratives of our own lives. All of those kinds of things. And A Perfect Spy, I think, takes that to another level. Because, of course, it is at some very fundamental way, it's an autobiography. So it's got that extra charge to it, I think. But as you're reading it, you can be ignorant of the fact that it's an autobiography and just that sense that you kind of know when you start, the walls are closing in on Magnus. This sense of inevitability and the looming tragedy, I think it's really, really superbly done. That's the book, isn't it, that Philip Roth said was the best British book since the war or whatever. And he's not wrong. I mean, it's a fantastic book.
Well, and I think Tinker Tailor was kind of the key for Le Carre in realizing that he can tell the stories he wants to with that kind of spy background, but like something more than that. I think after Naive and Sentimental Lover, where he really tried to make that literary novel, he was like, let me try and just mush the two together and see if I can make something greater than the two. And I think he succeeded.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually, some of the subsequent books, I think there's a general sense with Le Carre that the high point is sort of 70s, 80s, and then there's a coda. And I think there's some truth in that, but I think some of those later books are excellent. I love The Night Manager. I like The Tailor of Panama. I mean, The Tailor of Panama is a kind of riff on Our Man in Havana, the Graham Greene book. But The Tailor of Panama is very funny. You know, the relationship between, what's his name? Andrew Osnard. Is that the name of the agent?
Yeah.
I think it's really well done. Even some of the lesser known ones. Single and Single. I liked that. I liked Our Game.
Our Game is great, yeah.
Yeah. So I have a kind of soft spot for some of those. Personally, for me, I think actually once you get to, it's probably around about 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, that Le Carre starts to go off the boil for me, because I really feel like I'm being lectured when I read those books. And I don't want a novel to lecture me. I want it to breathe and to feel real. I think the other thing is that I think it's so terrible to be on a Le Carre podcast, like pointing out where I think Le Carre's gone wrong. Like, I mean, he's like, you know, one of the great post-war British writers, and I'm not. So I just to be absolutely clear, I'm not in a position to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think the some of the writing becomes a bit mannered, and I can remember reading something like A Kind of Traitor or whatever, one of those books, and thinking people don't actually really talk like this in, you know, that sort of quite arch way that people talk to each other in some of the Carre's later books, particularly when they're people who are within the intelligence service. They talk in this incredibly mannered way. And I thought to myself, that might have been how they talked in the 50s, but they don't talk like that now. So I don't believe that these characters really exist and are saying these things to each other. Anyway, that's just my problem, because, I mean, you know, as I said, Le Carre is a great writer and I'm not, so I'm not in a position to tell him off about his writing.
Well, I think you're not off point. I'm trying to remember which one it was, maybe Agent Running in the Field, where, you know, this character is supposed to be in his 40s and you're like, he's talking more like somebody who's in his 60s, 70s.
Exactly.
So there's a little off step there when it came to some of that stuff.
But I think that's inevitable when you have an older writer.
Sure.
Often that an older writer who's probably hanging around a lot with older people and is not incredibly familiar, because obviously when he does meet younger people, the younger people probably adjust their idiom to match his. So he's probably not conscious of how they talk when they're talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's... So I think maybe I should cut him a bit of slack on that.
You know, I obviously do deep dives on Le Carre and done a lot of reading. And one of the little nuggets I found out that Blistics, which is a lip balm company in the U.S., used to hand out the Most Beautiful Lips Awards.
Oh, right. Okay.
And in 1983, the winner of the Most Intriguing Lips was none other than John Le Carre.
Most Intriguing Lips. Wow.
And that same year, Margaret Thatcher won with the Most Stiff Upper Lip. And I wonder, there's this kind of weird relationship between of mutual admiration between the two of them, which seems completely unlikely in my mind, at least from what I understand about both of their politics. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, he's precisely the kind of novelist that she would read if she read novels. I mean, she did read novels. It was often said of her by her critics that she was a terrible Philistine who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. And that's not really true, that she had no ear for poetry and no soul and that sort of stuff, because she was quite a reader. She liked generally quite conservative things, so she loved Kipling's poetry. We know from her papers that she read Dostoevsky's book Demons, or The Possessed, depending on which title you go with, in about 1977, 78. So she's reading quite highbrow stuff. And she mentions Le Carre a few times as somebody that she reads. And then in the early to mid-1980s, a conservative peer, so a member of the House of Lords, who was a historian called Hugh Thomas, great historian of the Spanish Civil War and of Cuba, among other places, decided to organize a dinner for her among intellectuals and writers. He basically wanted to do this to say, you know, not all writers hate you, because that was the sort of... That was the mood in mid-80s Britain. And Mrs. Thatcher was winning all these elections, but sort of quite high-minded, literary, artistic people loathed her. He wants to organise this dinner, and so he's asking, you know, I don't know, Philip Larkin, Kingsley Amis, kind of conservative literary figures to turn up, the playwright Tom Stoppard. Will they come to this dinner? And Le Carré was invited, and he replied and said, I can't but admire her enormously. Tell her I admire her and respect her and all this kind of stuff. And I was really surprised when I saw that, because I thought Le Carré, everything we know about him suggests his later sensibilities are very much left of center. But I think there is a conservatism to Le Carré in some ways. He's a creature of institutions. You know, he might have kicked against those institutions, but he's shaped by those institutions, by Sherborne, his school, by the British Army, by the intelligence services and so on. And I think for a lot of people of his generation and background, they might have deplored some of Mrs. Thatcher's policies, but they regarded her as a necessary corrective and kind of reinvigoration after what they saw as years of decline. Yeah, I don't think she would be bothered about his politics at all, but I thought it was interesting. I thought it showed a complexity to him, sort of politically, that perhaps wasn't there later on. The thing about Mrs. Thatcher's lips, by the way, François Mitterrand famously said of her, President of France, he famously said of Mrs. Thatcher, she had the eyes of Caligula and the lips of Marilyn Monroe. And from a Frenchman, I believe that's a compliment.
I think so.
I interviewed Adam Sismanov about his biography of Le Carré.
Yeah.
Especially his second one that he recently released. And he spoke about being compelled to write that second book to offer kind of a complete picture of the man that he couldn't offer while he was still alive.
Yeah.
And do you find yourself in conflict as a historian who I would imagine you want as much information as out there, right? You want it all about a historical figure.
Yeah.
But then reading the novels, like, does that cause any conflict for you to, like, can you separate those out? Is that easy for you to do? Or does it add a different level to what your reading is?
It's a good question. I think personally, I think as a reader, you always have to be able to separate the creator from the work, because otherwise, how many great books are written by people who we might consider deplorable in various ways because they're racist or because whatever, you know, all the host of reasons, they behave very badly. So the work exists independent of its creator. But obviously with something like Le Carré's output, there are so many interesting relationships between the work and the creator that it would be weird not to want to try and explore them. I mean, I think the interesting thing with the biography, so I remember reviewing the biography, and then Le Carré did the Pigeon Tunnel kind of at the same time. So it seemed like they were in slight tension with each other. The Pigeon Tunnel, which was unbelievably evasive, I thought. It's very readable, but it's obviously in no way a kind of candid memoir. And then I also reviewed the other book. I don't know if you've covered this on your podcast, the book by Le Carré's lover, Sulika Dawson. You're aware of this book, I imagine?
Yeah.
So I reviewed that, and I gave that a really bad review, because I thought that was, I think even for a historian, the desire to know everything about somebody, there has to be a limit, especially when their children and their family are still alive. And I remember right when I wrote that review, I mean, I gave the book an absolute kicking, and I said what I thought, which is, there are some things you just don't need to know. We don't need to know about what Le Carré got up to in bed or whatever, or that sort of stuff. Much as we as historians may crave to know every detail of the past, I mean, a historian is a voyeur to an extent. You're kind of spying on other people's lives. But they are other people. They're not just your characters. And I think they're people with families and friends and all that sort of stuff, and that they would want to have something private would seem to me entirely natural and healthy. And the idea of basically cashing in by revealing details that basically the world would only need to know out of want or want to know out of a kind of a prurience and the very worst aspects of the kind of voyeurism that's within us all. So I just kind of felt that was unnecessary. I mean, with Adam doing two books, I can understand that, because I think he felt that the first book, because it left a lot out about the personal life, he felt that that was an incomplete portrait. And that actually, to make sense of Le Carré as a writer and as a kind of public figure and as a cultural figure, that you needed some of the other stuff. And if that wasn't set down and was lost, then we would be missing something. So as you said, the very peculiar business with his friend and friend's wife in the 60s, late 60s, James Kenaway, is it?
Yeah.
If we didn't know that, now that is the kind of thing that you might say, well, you might want to keep it private. But knowing that does allow us to make sense of Le Carré's life in a different way. I don't think it's unnecessary. It's helpful. But some of the more corporeal details that we get from the Sulika Dawson book, I don't think they're necessary at all. They don't shed any light on Le Carré's art Whereas I think knowing the other stuff about the affairs in the 60s, I think it does make sense of his art in a different light.
Putting him in context, your pamphlet, you say he's one of the greatest writers, but on your podcast, we've seen you discuss Tolkien, Conan Doyle, Fleming, Harry Potter, Christie, no Le Carre. So how important of a writer do you really think he is? You write about him in the Great British Steam Factory.
Yeah.
You talk about the imprint Britain has had on popular culture. You know, do you think Le Carre ranks up there? Will his work still be read, you think, 20, 50, 100 years from now? I mean, you look at another successful by novelist of his era, Len Dayton.
Yeah.
He's kind of faded away, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good question. It's a very good comparison. I was just thinking, I was glad you mentioned Len Dayton, because I was like, Len Dayton. I mean, I could go on about this for ages. I think it's an absolutely fascinating question about why writers last and why particular cultural archetypes last. And often it can be very random and it has nothing to do with quality. Well, first of all, and those things that I've talked about on the Rest Is History with my co-presenter, Tom, we've talked about Harry Potter, we've talked about The Lord of the Rings, we've talked about Sherlock Holmes, let's say, and the light that they shed on modern culture and modern history. Now, some of your listeners may say, what, Harry Potter and modern history, modern culture? But of course, if that was a phenomenon of the Anglo-Saxons or of kind of the 14th century, we'd want to study. We'd be really, really interested in it if it was kind of Thomas Malory's Mort Arthur or his chivalry romances or something, or Beowulf. Just because it's initially for children doesn't make, I mean, it's not interesting for a historian. The difference in those things and Le Carre's work are, to be blunt, they're much more popular. So their cultural imprint is greater. In other words, if I were to go out now, you know, in about an hour, I'm going to go and pick up my son from school. And if I went to the town where he goes to school and asked 20 people in the streets, you've heard of Sherlock Holmes, you've heard of The Lord of the Rings, they'd all say yes. Some of them, I think a fair number of them would not have heard of John le Carré. In Britain, this is. Or they would say, oh yeah, a writer maybe of something, I've never read it. And then a proportion, I don't know, probably less than half. So in fact, definitely less than half would have maybe read some of his books. That's not to diminish Le Carré. I mean, that'd be true of the vast majority of writers. I mean, of all writers, pretty much. So the people we talked about in the podcast in that way, though the phenomena have been extraordinary. Harry Potter, an extraordinary phenomenon. Sherlock Holmes, ditto. James Bond, the same. So Le Carré's not a phenomenon in the same league. There's no Le Carré theme park. People don't have Le Carré t-shirts, by and large. I mean, maybe some of your podcast aficionados do, but you know, they don't. There's no Le Carré merchandising phenomenon. That said, if you're talking to a kind of a very literary-minded, educated person, you say such and such reads like a Le Carré, or this feels very John Le Carré, doesn't it? I mean, we've actually used that expression on our podcast. Oh, it feels like something from a Le Carré book. People know what you mean. Will they always know what you mean? I'm not sure. I think Le Carré is probably somebody like Eric Ambler, who wrote in the 1920s, 1930s, a wonderful writer. That might be a plausible destination for Le Carré's reputation. Although I think Le Carré is a better writer, a richer, more ambitious writer. So I'd put him a level above that. So in other words, I think if Le Carré lasts, it won't be as somebody who speaks to, you know, is part of kind of popular culture in the same way, but it's somebody who is regarded as a classic writer. And I think he deserves that. When I look at post-war British writing, so there are some figures I could throw out names and they would be meaningless to your listeners. So somebody like, I will do, just to torment everybody. So a writer like Angus Wilson. Angus Wilson in the 1950s and 1960s was a very well-known writer. His books were reviewed in every single big newspaper. In Britain, the level he was at would be similar to the level that, let's say, John Updike or someone had in the United States. He didn't really trot across the Atlantic. People didn't read his stuff in America, I don't think. I'm not even sure whether it was published in America. He had a big reputation. His books, I think, are now all out of print and nobody will ever read them again. He's gone. That's it. Yeah, the ship has sailed. Who knows why? Nobody ever made a film of them. They weren't suited for TV. They weren't taught in schools. As a result, people just stopped reading them. William Golding, massive writer, Lord of the Flies. Lord of the Flies will endure because it seems to say something about human nature. The idea of the kids on the island, they all turn on each other. Maybe Anthony Burgess, another really big writer of the same era in Britain, A Clockwork Orange, because it's such an extraordinary thing, will endure. The rest of his books, no. Le Carré, I mean, the one thing Le Carré has that they don't have is his books are incredibly exciting. A spy thriller, even an old spy thriller, people will always read.
So I think they'll always be in print. They'll survive in that kind of Penguin Classics edition. I'm talking about 50 or 100 years' time, by the way. They'll always survive as wonderful historical artifacts. There'll be, not many, but there'll be a minority of very strange people in the 23rd century who are interested in Britain in the 70s or the 80s and will say the best way to, you know, to get into that world, just like if you want to read about mid-19th century France, you'd read Balzac or Flaubert. So you'll read Le Carré for Britain in the post-war period. So I think they'll last for that reason. But the fact that they last at all is amazing. Most writers just simply do not last. This is true of American writers as a British. My wife, her PhD was on Philip Roth, John Updike, and Don DeLillo, on terms of the great American novelists. But even now, their reputation is kind of under attack, fading. Will people still read them in 100 years' time? You know, people who are thought of as great writers, there's always a falling away because, you know, they stop being reprinted in the same numbers. Maybe if you end up as a school text, that obviously ensures you a place in the canon. Something like Harry's book's quite short, so you could imagine them ending up in a kind of school or university curriculum. Imagine teaching The Spy Who Came In From the Cold to enthusiastic students, who would be incredible. So actually, I'm quite optimistic about Le Carré's reputation. And I think his historical significance, to me, he feels much more interesting than many people who won prizes in the 70s and 80s in Britain. So looking back at the big prizes, the Booker Prize, if I were to list off for your listeners the winners in, you know, 1983, 1984, or whatever, people are like, what? Who? What's this? Whereas, so Le Carré's books will endure where those books don't. So this is a very long-winded way of saying he'd be a great subject for our podcast. And I think he is really historically important. And I think they will endure, not at the level of Conan Doyle or Tolkien, which are gigantic phenomena. That's an unfair yardstick. You know, who's ever going to compete with Conan Doyle in creating a character that is recognized the world over? I mean, just to endure as Le Carré will, I think, is an extraordinary achievement in and of itself.
Do you have time for like two lightning questions?
Sure.
Or you got to go?
Yeah, no, let's do it.
So I know you play Assassin's Creed.
Oh, yeah.
You're a big fan.
Yeah.
Do you see a 1970s Le Carré-esque Assassin's Creed game ever?
Right.
Would you enjoy playing that one?
I would. I would. I don't know if I shamed myself by making this confession. So obviously my son is 12, so he plays lots of video games. And I grew up, I'm of that generation. I had home computer in the 80s and played games and kind of never really grew out of the habit. So yeah, how would it work? I mean, it'd be very murky. There'd be rubbish in the streets. People would be on strike. That would be fun. I think it would be brilliant, but I think Ubisoft, the creators, they've yet to come to me and ask for me to do the important consultancy work, but I am available.
So yeah, right.
That would be really good. Of course, you'd be like climbing Big Ben and stuff and foiling, I don't know.
Assassinations of Marcia Williams.
Right, exactly. You'd be, you know, there would be some, there would be a kind of terrorism element to it, and there'd be something about trying to, what else happened in Britain in the 70s? It'd be stuff to do with the trade unions and then having to go to the IMF for a bit. You'd have to organize a bailout from the International Monetary Fund at some point. That's never been done in a video game, so it would be a real breakthrough.
All right, Andor. Everything a Star Wars and a Le Carré fan would want from a TV show. You've watched Andor, I would hope.
Yeah. Wow. What a nice note on which to end. So, of course. So, my heretical opinion. I mean, do you really want me to go into this?
Let's hear it. If you've got the time, I'm ready to hear it.
So, my heretical opinion is that Rogue One is the best Star Wars film.
Oh, wow.
It's maybe not necessarily my favorite, because my favorite will always be Star Wars, because that's the first one I saw. But I thought Rogue One was absolutely brilliant. Loved it. Kind of a desert island film for me. And then Andor came out, and I can remember we're about 4 or 5 episodes in, and my son, who probably, it was a couple of years ago that it came out, isn't it? Or a year or two ago. I remember him saying to me, there is a lot of talking. There is a lot of talking. And he said that his friends at school, a lot of them had given up on it, the kind of other 10 or 11-year-olds, because they said there's so much politics. And I said, oh, that's brilliant though, isn't it? All this politics. And of course, it is very Le Carré-like. The kind of double agents and also that sense of being morally compromised. So the Stellan Skarsgård character, he has this fantastic monologue, doesn't he? Where he says, basically, I'm living a lie for this cause. And I'm giving up the whole of my life to live this lie. and giving up, sacrificing everything because I believe in the cause of undermining the empire and stuff. I think it's great. I think it's really, really good. I'm absolutely of that generation that watched Star Wars when I watched Star Wars when I was a little boy. And as is the way, when you fall in love with something when you are six, it's very hard to fall out of love with it, no matter how terrible the subsequent iterations of it are. It has an enormous sentimental place in my imagination. Andor was everything that I would have ever wanted Star Wars to become. It's grown up. It's morally complicated. It's clever. It's surprising. It's brilliantly made. The acting in it, the actors they can call upon, absolutely fantastic. So yeah, I love it. I'm so glad you brought that up. I could talk about it all day.
Thank you so much for coming on to talk Le Carre with me. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been an enormous honor. I've really enjoyed it. I'm so sorry for talking too much. And I hope all your listeners will forgive me. But thank you very much for having me.
What's the best way for folks to keep up with what you're doing?
So my big thing really these days is this podcast we do called The Rest is History. We release two episodes every week on totally different things. So sometimes we're doing ancient Carthage or ancient Babylon or the Romans. And then other times we've done 70s Britain, the origins of the First World War, the French Revolution, Nixon, Watergate, you name it. So we do that, and I am on Twitter at DC Sandbrook.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. I love the podcast, so I highly recommend folks check it out. You will not be disappointed.
I'll have links to Dominic's work in the show notes. If this is your first time listening, there are a ton of other episodes you might enjoy. I've interviewed Adam Sisman, Le Carre's biographer, talked through even more on shabby 70s London, and done deep dives on a number of his novels, with even more to come. You can find them all in the podcast feed or at lecarrecast.com. If you've enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen will really help others try it. And if you're a giant Le Carre fan with an interesting perspective on his work, drop me a line. I'm always on the hunt for new guests and topics. Email me at lecarrecast@gmail.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.